and land to the natives up here in Alaska, we believe that land is not something that you own. Land is something that you use, take care of, interact with, and harmonize with. And it is to be respected as such because it provides anything and everything for us that we live on. It's only since our interaction with the Western society that we have even thought of owning land. But if in fact that is the only way that the Western society understands land and its use, then we are going to adapt to that also. And please don't be ever mistaken to think that the Native people of Alaska are going to abide by the Claim Settlement Act boundaries. We were not raised that way, and we don't raise our children that way. Our land boundaries are very ancient, and I see a movement afoot now for the Native peoples to start saying, okay, since the Western society does not abide by or even recognize oral, unwritten boundaries, and by golly, we're going to put them down so that you do recognize them. And we may not ever get title to them, but we still believe that we exert jurisdiction over them. And I will always make the point that political power is always at the will, at the goodwill of the people. And if they say, and by they I mean the tribal members, if they say that that is the direction that they want their leaders to go, then they better go that way. Thank you.
I think I should say this morning, Mr. Kachetag, you said that political power comes from the people. There was a discussion, a very lengthy discussion, throughout this week, turning on that very question, and people around the table and some who are now gone. Back to the Lower 48, discuss the question, where does sovereignty come from? And I won't say that there was unanimity on the point, but the same question that you asked was asked here, and a number of answers offered. Joe Jorgensen and then David Case.
Pardon the redundancy, but I did want to respond to Mr. Kachetag's point about where trust responsibility sits. 2 days ago, I mentioned the Western Shoshone case. I want to bring it up one more time. The Western Shoshone had ceded to them about 15 million acres in western Utah and Nevada. They seek the return of that land, and they have asserted ownership over it for many, many years. They have continued to hunt on land that is either federal or state land and gone to court over it. They continue to run their cattle on federal or state lands without paying fees on it, have been taken to court over that. And now they seek, and on March 11th they will meet with the Senate Select Committee, as well as with their own leadership and with their attorneys and with the Bureau of Indian Affairs, in an attempt to do several things, one of which is to gain title to that land and that it not be conveyable, and that the protection for them come under the Indian Non-Intercourse Act. There's no mention of trusteeship vested in the Secretary of the Interior or in the federal government, but there is protection through the Indian Non-Intercourse Act. It might be instructive and worthwhile to watch what happens in these negotiations that are going on now, and they may have some application, although the case is very different from the Alaska situation, they may have some application down the road for Alaska Natives.
David Case.
Yeah, I have about three short, and I hope short, and answer specific questions for Mr. Koningsberg. You said there were some tax advantages to this kind of transaction. Could you briefly elaborate on that?
You know, the Tax Treatment Extension Act of 1980, which amended the Internal Revenue Code, allows tax benefits from the conveyance of an easement, or excuse me, the execution of an easement to a trust organization. In other words, if a rancher gives us an easement over his property, he's under tax law allows him to claim a deduction, a charitable contribution, because by giving up his development rights, he gives up a certain value. And you're looking at substantial, for instance, give you an example in Montana in the Madison Valley, a 15,000 acre ranch would be worth approximately $5 million. The donation of the development rights to the Montana Land Alliance is based on an appraisal of the before and after value, and that will generally run around 50% of that $5 million, so that he's given a charitable contribution of $2.5 million to the Montana Land Alliance, which he then takes as a deduction on federal income tax. The application on corporate lands under that code is that a corporation can take a deduction. Let's say a native corporation were to assign an easement to considerable acreage. Apart from the problem of figuring out the value of that gift, the tax law would allow the corporation to deduct from 10% of its adjusted gross income the value of that gift over a period of 6 years. There are amendments that President Reagan has suggested a 15-year carryover period. We don't know if that's going to happen, but that's for a corporate entity, those are the tax advantages. It's a straightforward deduction from income.
And am I correct in my understanding that the advantage of this approach doesn't arise from the fact that it is managed by a trust, but it arises from the legal status of an easement being a restriction on the land no matter who controls it?
Yes, that's it's the strongest, at least as far as we're able to tell, it's the strongest mechanism to protect certain conservation purposes, regardless of future ownership.
What would happen if the trust ceased to exist?
Well, the trust, there's provisions within the easement to allow for the conveyance of the protection of the easement to another organization. Under federal law, any 501c3 group organized exclusively for conservation purposes can enforce an easement, can accept an easement, and any public agency, whether it's local, state, or federal, can accept an easement donation. So there's provisions in the easement itself to allow a transfer of the document.
Kim, do you want to say something now, or is it okay? And finally, are lands covered by the easement subject to state or federal condemnation?
We've had that asked many times from ranchers whose lands are in danger of being crossed by power lines, gas lines, roads. Under certain conditions, yes, but generally, no. An easement does not protect land from condemnation. There was a situation in district court, I think it was in federal court with the Nature Conservancy in the state of Minnesota, where, this is an interesting example, a large utility company had built, I think it was 765 kV transmission lines, which are the biggest built in the United States these days, to the owner's property. Now, they built the lines up to the west boundary and up to the east boundary, they assumed they could go in and condemn the land so they could cross. What had happened was the Conservancy had accepted an easement from the rancher and had in turn given the land to the State Department of Natural Resources as a special management area. The courts ruled that the management by the State Department constituted prior public use and didn't allow for condemnation by the utility company. So there are, you know, there's case law that says under certain conditions you cannot condemn property where an easement has made possible public management.
Is that all your questions, David? Before we call on Kim Gottschalk, it seems to me that the Australian model may come very close to what Mr. Kachetag is urging. That is, there, the land is held in trust, but it is a, as I understand it, a private trust, and the trust acts on instructions. The trustee acts on instructions from the Native Land Council, we will find out more about that because we have five Australian Aboriginal people coming here on Tuesday, and maybe they'll be able to tell us more. Kim, go. I don't know. I think it must be under state legislation because it was achieved in South Australia before, I believe, the federal government assumed jurisdiction over native lands. But I can't answer that question.
Well, in our case here, then, you could set up a similar trust under state law, which would be protected by the federal courts if you took it that far, right? At least that's the way I would see it operating.
Well, you may be right. I was, as a matter of fact, I was hoping that Kim and then Kim Goddard and then Ralph Johnson and David Case might comment on Sheldon Kachetag's proposal and on the appropriateness of the Australian model here in Alaska. And perhaps David Case might also tell us whether what has occurred at Venati has any bearing on this discussion. I should say for the record, that was Walter Parker who asked the last two questions. Kim Gottschalk.
I want to make sure that I understand the implications of what you're saying, and that if I understand what I think you're saying, I think it's very important that everyone else have it clarified as well. I think you're suggesting that at a given point in time, someone will sit down and decide what this easement is about, and from that time on, in perpetuity, if the native view stays exactly the same, consistent with that purpose, everything will be fine. Should it ever vary, what you're saying in effect, that future governmental entities run by native people will have no say over the change, if any, of how their land is used. In other words, to a certain extent, if future goals deviate from what is set out in that document, they have lost all control over the future development of their land. Is that right?
I'm not sure I understood your question, but what the easement would allow would be certain kinds of development within certain parameters in perpetuity. In our case,
laid down in the easement.
All easements in the lower 48 that are conservation easements, we get, you know, that's a concern of a lot of farmers and ranchers. And I'm only raising this as a model. I'm not saying it answers the Alaska situation at all. But an analogy is we've got concerns that if we do this in perpetuity, that means it can never change. Our response, there's two responses. One, in our situation, we're dealing with the imminent threat of subdivision or wholesale resource exploitation, such as strip mining. So our response generally to that question or that concern is that your concern about the irremedial aspects of the easement are somewhat ill-founded in that any use of the land in the future that would be subdivision or mining in perpetuity will restrict its future use, and that the easement document permits the land at some point in the future, if I would assume that legislation, we assume that if the social need is such that that land has to be subdivided or mined, that legislation or court decisions will permit that particular parcel to actually go out of its agricultural use and break the easement. So we can't answer that with any finality. All we can say is it's the securest way of preserving a use that you dedicate it toward in the future.
Well, but if I understand you, your goal is to get the most ironclad agreement you could to make it be committed to a given use, which as long as the native government feels that that use is what they want, is fine. But should they disagree with it, you've tied their hands.
Right. You've tied it.
Might I just see if we can follow that thought up? If land were dedicated to subsistence by a perpetual easement in Alaska, and no deviation from that use were countenanced by the easement document, then native people controlling the land, whether through a native government or a corporation, if the easement meant anything at all, could not develop the land in the future. But state legislation could change all that. In other words, in Montana, the easement is subject to state legislation. The state's overriding power to say this easement is no longer in force. Have I got that right?
Yeah, the specific instance that that would be permitted that we know of would be if a land that was dedicated to agriculture, the surrounding land use, changed so much as to prevent agricultural use of the property, the courts would extinguish the easement. We're only making the assumption that if society at some point deemed exploitation of the land that we have under easement as necessary, they'd find a way to do that. But we can only operate within the law, you know, framework that we have.
Ralph Johnson, and then Al Guzman.
Ralph Johnson, a very short comment. I presume the easement could provide that either a majority of the beneficiaries, that is of the village or of the tribe, could change it, or that a two-thirds majority or a seven-tenths majority or whatever. I mean, the easement could provide for a change in use depending upon whatever the easement prescribed were the terms. I mean, that isn't what you do in Montana, but the one that would be devised here could reflect whatever the native group wanted to do.
Ralph, I
can't answer whether or not that would be possible under a conservation easement in Alaska. You may be right. We haven't had experience with that. Our easements don't allow for any future owners to make any changes in the easement use.
Could I, just before we leave you, Mr. Johnson, and go to Mr. Guzmer, could I ask you about Mr. Kachetag's proposition? I take it that nowhere in the Lower 48 is land held by tribal governments in perpetuity as trustees for the members of the tribe, that the owner and trustee is the federal government in all instances.
Well, that's not correct. There are only the land that is held in trust is held by the federal government. The various Indian tribes own land off the reservation. They also own some lands on the reservation that has not been accepted back in trust by the Secretary of the Interior. And so that's
those lands that come from the restoration.
Well, in the Colville Reservation, for example, I believe it's also true in the Yakima, you buy back lands, don't you? You have a policy, your Colvilles, I know, have a policy of repurchasing lands. If a non-Indian owned lands on the reservation decides he wants to sell, then the tribe usually tries to buy it. And if they buy the land, then it's a question whether the Secretary of Interior will accept it back in trust or whether the tribe wants it to go back in trust. But then it's just owned, the tribe owns Black Acre as Black Acre.
And the
so that on some reservations, some land may be held in trust by the federal government for the tribe, other land is held in fee simple
by
the tribal government.
That's exactly right. Not very much, but there is such land. Yeah. I might ask.
Mr. Jim?
Yes. Also keep in mind that in order to put the land back into trust, purchase by the tribe, you seem to have a certain colored money, FHA monies that come from perhaps the selling of, you have to sell trust resources to use that money to purchase the fee land for it to go back into trust, or you use borrowed money from FHA that has that certain hue or tint to go and purchase land and put it back into trust. But were you to use tribal dollars strictly out of the treasury to purchase that fee land, it would remain in fee. Some of the complications that perhaps Mr. Johnson might be able to address much better than I, but.
Just before we go to Mr. Guzmer, could I ask David Case to comment and tell us whether Venati has any bearing on this discussion?
All right. I wanted to ask Mr. Jim, though, are the Yakimas an IRA tribe?
No, sir. We rejected the IRA in 47, somewhere there.
Right. And was that account, Ralph, for the reason that the land could not be taken into trust under the IRA? Or is that, well, Mr. Jim's nodding yes, so.
Well, in part, yes. The promises, if you take this, we will provide you with this and this and this, and that was one of the things that said you you would be able to purchase your lands directly back with your treasury monies directly back into trust if you are a member of the IRA, but we refused IRA, and that's just one of the complications for some reason or other that was created.
I'm not sure if I want to say this, but I will anyway. That portion of the IRA has been amended. You may know Section 5 has been amended to apply, I think, to any tribe, whether it's rejected the IRA or not. That was just last year. The Devil's Lake Sioux Band had a statute put through Congress, and they put a little amendment to the IRA on it. And I don't know if that will eliminate the need to go for the FHA money under that other statute, which is, but it's, I'm not sure of the effect of all this recent amendment either, but it may or may not address that question. The Venati situation, I don't think I will really speak directly to that. But let me just say something about the.
That is land held by a tribe.
Well, let's clarify that. Yes, that's true. The lands of the former reservation of Venati, about 1.8 million acres, were conveyed under the Claims Act to the village corporations, two village corporations which occupied that former reservation. And they, as a matter of fact, before they even received the land, conveyed it to the Venati tribal government. And it is held by the Venati tribal government as fee lands. This idea of holding lands in trust, I mean, it means many different things, I suspect. If we are talking about actually putting the land into a trust under state law. I mean, this is a legal concept, And there are provisions under state law whereby landowners can put land, transfer land in trust to other people or other entities. And that may be possible legally for a corporation to transfer the lands in trust to such an entity, and perhaps including a tribe. It's important to be careful in doing that, that that you understand the consequences of, under state law, of putting land in trust. I am told, and I haven't done this research myself, though, but that if the trust document is not specific on the terms of the trust, I mean, how the land will be managed, under what conditions, and by whom, and so forth, that the Attorney General for the state of Alaska is the trustee if there is ever any dispute about the nature of the trust. It is important to be careful about the involvement of the state of Alaska if it is with respect to the management of those lands, I suppose. Another thing that I suspect is being suggested is that the fact the land is held by a tribe which has sovereign immunity is equivalent to a kind of trust in that it, for all practical purposes, prevents most kinds of involuntary loss or alienation by a judgment or by state condemnation. It protects against all of those things, as long as the tribe's sovereign immunity is retained. And that may be what is being suggested by trust. I mean, trust has a kind of it's like sovereignty, I think. It has a kind of a general meaning of good faith and being fair about things and very, 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 very honest. And it has another sense, which is a more legal, narrowly legally defined sense, which I associate with property management and property law.
Just before we move on to Mr. Guzmer and Mr. Lerner, would you forgive me if I just tried to clear up the rest of this legal debris that we've got here? This is probably a stupid question, but the chairman should be willing to ask stupid questions. Where a tribe in the United States has recovered, or at least has purchased land from a non native person on the reservation, that land can then be alienated by the tribe. It doesn't require federal government consent, I take it, just as it would be free to alienate land it held in fee off the reserve. Have I got that right, Mr. Johnson?
True. It can sell the land like anyone else can sell it because it's not held in trust by the United States government. I guess a question that I've not tried to worry about is whether it's restrained by the Non-Intercourse Act from the sale of that land to anyone. In other words, federal law latches onto it at the instant of acquisition by the tribe, so that although it's not held in trust, that it's subject to the restrictions of the Non-Intercourse Act. I don't know, is that your reaction?
David Case? Well, that's my understanding, that the Non-Intercourse Act applies, I mean, by its terms, to tribally owned land. It doesn't say tribal trust land or tribal reserved land or anything else. It's an old statute, but it does just say tribally owned land. And I'm not aware of any court decisions that have faced the question of the Non-Intercourse Act application to tribally owned fee land. The solicitor did write a letter regarding the tribally owned land in Benatai.
You mean the solicitor for the
Interior Department,
yeah.
The United States. The
solicitor with a capital S for the record.
Depends on your style manual, I suppose. the question, probably a lot of us are aware, Benatai leased its all or a large part of the of the lands that are owned by the tribal government to an oil company for exploration for oil. And there were several million dollars hanging on that deal. And the oil company was judicious and wanted to be sure that, this could be done without the approval of the Secretary of the Interior, and they were largely concerned about the Non-Intercourse Act, which is probably irrelevant because the Non-Intercourse Act requires an act of Congress or a treaty and not just the Secretary's approval. Well, in any event, the solicitor wrote a letter which said that, in his opinion, the Claims Act, as I recall, had satisfied the requirements of the Non-Intercourse Act as far as these ANCSA lands were concerned. People that do this even more than I do for a living have said that that is just simply wrong, that that opinion is wrong, and that the Non-Intercourse Act would nonetheless apply to tribally owned ANCSA lands. So, I mean, you know, there's nothing you can get two lawyers to agree about, and I suppose that demonstrates it.
I should add to this that another aspect of the question is whether the land is on the reservation, is within the exterior boundaries of the reservation. If it is, it is Indian country under 18 U.S. Code 1151. If it is not on the reservation, then under the Mescalero case, it is subject to state taxation. And any income from the land, in other words, if the Yakima tribe buys a hotel in Seattle, heaven forbid they'd want to, but if they bought one in Seattle, then the profit from that hotel would be subject, or the building itself would be subject to state taxation. But it wouldn't be held in trust.
The well, Mr. Guzmer,
there's a couple comments on. We're talking about a lot of different vehicles and different entities to deal with Native issues here. And the way we see it, I believe in, you know, in my point of view, that what vehicle are we going to use to have this land status? And I believe that the IRA and traditional form of governments are the best vehicle to be used. As stated by Mr. Johnson, that if a tribe owns a piece of property in as we do, we own a lot of property here in Anchorage, and we are being taxed for that. So the Tribal Government Tax Status Act of 1982 doesn't apply to that form of taxes. We still have to pay taxes, but then the vehicle that I feel that has to be used, it would be with traditional or IRA form of governments, because the people, the power comes from the people. And Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act was based on valid existing rights. The rhetoric that's going on, who's going to be controlling the land, the traditional government, the IRA government, or the corporation formed under ANCSA. And under the Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act, the people have the power to say what vehicle is going to administer that land. And all you need is two-thirds of the vote from the people to say that the Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act, this land is going to belong to the people, to the IRA government. On valid existing rights, we do have that status. We do have that control of saying what vehicle are we going to use to administer our land. You know, we're talking about state government, state corporations, IRA, traditional form of governments. Which one of those there are the best vehicle to use, to be used? And in my opinion, the traditional and the IRA form of government is that vehicle to be used, because under the 14th Amendment on due process, you know, Indian tribes have a status higher than state government, federal government, sovereignty. We never bought it, we never stole it, we never bartered for it. It is always ours, and it is based on valid existing rights that, in my opinion, that I believe that the traditional and IRA form of governments are the best vehicle to bring this issue to be addressed. under the Self-Determination Act of 1975, recognize Indian rights to control their relationship with both among themselves and with the non-Indian governments, organizations, and persons. Alaska is a PL-280 state, but this is also was amended to follow further assumption by state jurisdiction only with the approval of the tribes affected. Jurisdictional rights under the Cherokee Treaty Hopewell 1785, jurisdictional rights, any person of the United States or other person of the Indian shall attempt to settle on Indian land hereby allotted to Indians shall forfeit the protection of the United States and the Indians will punish him as they see fit. As governments, tribes have the general power to govern the conduct of persons, including non-Indians, in Indian country, established bodies such as tribal police, courts, to enforce and administer justice, to exclude or remove non-members for a cause, regulate hunting and fishing, land use, environmental protection, taxing, the whole thing. In my opinion, I believe that the vehicle that is best going to be used to address the problem is your tribal form of government and the people. That's where you get your power from. Under the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution, it says Indians are not states. They have a status higher than that of states. And under the Fifth Amendment, the Bill of Rights applies because only the federal government actions, and Indians are not federal powers. They have a government of their own that can control their own destiny. And under the Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act, under the valid existing rights, we can control those lands by 2/3 vote. Power derives from the people. At one time in our history, our unwritten laws and everything are still valid today as they were 10,000 years ago. At one time, we owned everything on the west side of Cook Inlet. I don't know if how familiar you guys are with this area, but then we did we said this land is ours. Okay, from Tuck Sydney Bay to Readout to Spur to Tyonek and to back to the water, all of that land is ours. We didn't need no those documents under the Western culture saying that. This is yours, Section 10, Township 10, latitude, all this other specific legal description of where your land is. I think, you know, that the land base is very important to us, and then this is, in my opinion, the vehicle that we have to use to settle this. Or address this issue.
Okay. Daily Sembo.
I'm just curious. Russell Jim mentioned earlier that they refused IRA, and they are a treaty tribe now, the Yakima Nation. I'm curious about why they refused IRA, as we have a suggestion that IRA is the vehicle or alternate vehicle here.
Mr. Jim.
I have an article here I wrote which seems to come back to haunt me once in a while because of my stand against the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And as you hear me, I call them sometimes an inept bureaucracy, mostly because of their non-definition and their seemingly loss or lack of identity
in regard to trust responsibility. And the Yakimas were approached to become an IRA tribe and refused because they felt that the implicitness and the full understanding of our ancestors when they returned from weeks of negotiating a treaty with the United States of America was not only sufficient, but it was the best avenue. And also, they felt that it would also give them the opportunity to formulate their own formal government in the eyes of the United States of America. So that's basically why the Yakimas refused, but I'm sure there were other influences, like in order to make a major decision or a major change, if and when you had became an IRA tribe, you must get permission from the Secretary of the Interior, as you well know. And that was more than likely an influence. While in Sun Valley, Idaho, at the Self-Rule Conference, you heard the many of those that had accepted IRA in the past were very disenchanted. Secretary of the Interior, for one reason or another, would go sit on a change or a suggestion or a direction the tribe wanted to go. And if he didn't sign it, they didn't go anywhere. I hope I answered your question.
They also, at the Sun Valley IRA conference, stated that at some points in time, the Secretary of Interior never even did approve the initial constitution to set the course for the IRA, and that it held his thumb down on it.
Yes, and there are tribes on the coast of the state of Washington that wish to change their constitution but are meeting much resistance. And many of these IRA constitutions were written by the members of the Bureau of Indian Affairs.
Daley Sambo, another question?
I wanted Ralph Johnson to expand a little bit upon the new developments and accomplishments that have taken place with respect to IRAs or traditional governments and their new the revitalization or the aggressive assertion of the IRA and traditional governments. At the Sun Valley IRA conference, there was a lot of displeasure expressed about IRAs, and I'm wondering if some of the statements that Russell has just made now and against the accomplishments that you recited either yesterday or the day before in terms of changes that have taken place from 1970 to 84 with respect to IRAs and traditional governments.
Well, what I was referring to then was that, this is Ralph Johnson, what I was referring to then was that some of the IRA tribes, and I should add that we tend to talk somewhat artificially here about tribes in the United States either being IRA tribes or non-IRA tribes. There are permutations that go all the way from 0 to 100. There are tribes that started out as IRA tribes and they haven't followed the forms of the IRA, so it's questionable whether they're IRA tribes. The IRA anticipated that you'd have a tribal government of a certain structure and you'd have a corporation to do business. And there's an enormous amount of intermixing of these ideas so that it is not clear when the corporation is acting and when the tribe is acting, which has important considerations of sovereign immunity, because when the tribe is acting as a corporation, then it doesn't have sovereign immunity, probably. When it's acting as a tribal government, it does have sovereign immunity. So what I want to go into this comment with is that It is not as if in the lower 48 there are neatly organized IRA tribes and the non-IRA tribes. There's a lot of confusion and mixture in that process. But let's take a tribe, some of those that at one time or another accepted the IRA and accepted the Secretary of Interior's authority to approve amendments to the tribal code or the tribal constitution. What's happened in recent years, and as I say, it's not a widely known thing, it isn't published widely, but what privately is happening is that a tribe goes to the Secretary of the Interior and says, we want to change our constitution so that you don't have any authority to refuse to approve our code or changes in our code. And he says, I won't do that. And then we say, and then the tribe says, we're going to do it anyway. And when it comes to the crunch, and when the pressure's on, the Secretary of the Interior can insist upon veto power or some control under one circumstance very clearly, and that is when trust property is involved. He refuses to relinquish that at all because he has a legal obligation to approve any action that would have to do with trust property or water rights, including water rights. The other area where the Secretary of the Interior has been particularly hard to deal with on this issue is when the Indian Civil Rights Act questions, due process questions are involved. He feels that he should exercise some review powers there. But aside from those two areas, there are all kinds of other activities that the tribe engages in, enacting laws or whatever, that is really not the Secretary's business. And when the tribe pushes very hard, the Secretary says, okay, then I won't insist upon my right of approval of that. Now, but realize that it sometimes the tribes view it in their own interest to get that approval, because if they wish to apply that ordinance to non-Indians on the reservation, for example, and you're going to have that challenged in a federal court, it sometimes is very influential to say, well, this was approved by the Secretary of the Interior, and so it has the stamp of the federal government on it.